Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. My name is Carl Shinneman, Director of Analytics and Review with Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested to listening to it, which is basically when you want to download it, store it on your computer, or put it in your iPod. Today we have a great show, as we've got Quinn Greger from Strategic Data Retention to talk about data mismanagement in e-discovery. The world of data is always evolving. Back in the day, about 4 years ago, say, we used to lose sleep over issues like managing or mismanaging backup tapes and then being forced to restore them in e-discovery matters. Our guest today, Quinn Greger, has a deep background in that regard, having worked on backup tapes and issues in the Zuba Lake case and providing expert opinion covering tapes and email during the Morgan Stanley case, too. But today, I think it's fair to say our issues of managing data have gotten far more complex. Data forms continue to be more varied. There are new tools to assist managing data at an enterprise level, which keep emerging. And data sources such as social media and cloud computing are throwing more wrinkles at getting our arms around ESI when litigation is impending. And one might ask, are we ever going to get there? But Quinn is a great guest to help with this topic. His background includes almost 30 years of data conversion and forensics, working in the oil industry, writing tape software for discovery of oil and gas for 21 years. In the mid-90s, his software was processing and analyzing over 5,000 tapes a day. He was worrying about how to manage 50 terabytes of new data on a daily basis for the world's largest oil company. Data management was a large part of the operations group he worked with, and he learned many valuable lessons that serve him well today. Quinn, thanks for joining us here on the show.
Thank you, Carl.
The first question I always like to ask, because you get such varied answers, is how did you get involved with electronic discovery?
I've been involved with discovery practically my entire career, but in terms of electronic discovery as we know it, after I left the oil industry, I joined EMAG Solutions in Atlanta, where I live. And they assigned me the task of selling their tape software, which for me was a big change, because up to that point, I'd been a hardcore techie. And so I was new to the sales process and bumbled along for a while. And after a year or so, I asked my clients what they were using the software for. Several profusely thanked me for allowing them to develop and create businesses using the software. So I asked some questions and I found out what tools they were using and very quickly created my own discovery lab. And within 6 weeks, I was making more for the company performing this sort of service than they were selling the software. In early 2003, I was returned to my roots and I was put back in charge of operations. And I started the electronic discovery practice for EMAG Solutions, and they're still very much in the business. I used my extensive data processing and forensics background to build the business and help convert EMAG from being a tape manufacturer, which they were at the time. They made under the name of Graham Magnetics, and we converted them into a services company. In 2005, I was asked to provide expert opinion for the now famous Morgan Stanley case. When I went down there, I didn't know what to expect, but it was exceptionally enlightening. The way the lawyers literally attacked the IT people at Morgan Stanley was both amazing and horrifying, and I was glad I wasn't in the stand. In that one day, my whole perception on how to manage data for IT and for discovery was totally transformed. Shortly after this, I joined LECG and had a lot of fun. Was able to put these lessons into very large and very complex cases. About a year and a half ago, I joined with an old friend at Strategic Data Retention here in Atlanta, and we're now creating software that allows for high-speed email conversion, analytics, and visualization.
Well, great. A lot of people's lives are changed by Morgan Stanley, so yeah. Interesting to talk to someone that was involved in it. So let's start by talking about what should data management mean and what does it mean in real practice? So if you want to jump into that question and take a whack at that.
Okay, to me, and I'm speaking from my perspective, it means three things: what, when, and where. So let's break that down. What do you have? You know, what does this data actually represent? What is the business content and business value of this data? And what does it represent to the company? What do the words contained in the documents actually mean? What are the concepts within the information, and how do these individual data items relate to each other? So that's one aspect. The next is, when was it created, and how long should it stay around for? Data lifecycle management, it's a widely used term. It's important. Key documents should be preserved for as long as they represent value to the company. When they represent risk, then the life cycle needs to be carefully controlled. However, the determination of what represents value versus risk is a whole different conversation. And obviously, there's a regulatory side of this too. And the last aspect is, where is it? Where is the data physically? On disk, in the cloud, in a warehouse, on tape? And how do I access it? The average user doesn't know or care, and they shouldn't really have to. The purpose of the data is to help the business operate, grow, and defend itself. However, from the computer operations department viewpoint, management's a key concern. Operations is rarely provided a viewpoint as to what the data is or what risk it represents, and makes decisions very much at the macro level, often in a vacuum. I believe this to be a very flawed approach. The stakeholders, i.e. the owners of the data and those who have an interest in it, need to have a say in what data is stored in what fashion.
Well, in deciding what to store is a pretty complicated question, given your description of how these are implemented. So how do you decide what to store?
It's a good question. Storage really occurs by default. And very often there's little or no decision about what to store, as it occurs for you automatically. Gone are the days when disk space was expensive. It's now so cheap and plentiful that storage space is no longer a consideration. In many corporations, the pressures on storage management and disk quotas are going away. And with it, from the user side, the need to think about what to store. From the corporate standpoint, there's still the need to create disaster recovery, or as it should be called, business continuity backups. So if the worst case does happen, the business can survive. Increasingly, this data is being backed up more and more to disk rather than tape, but the volumes of tape involved are still very, very significant, and this should not be overlooked. And despite what the pundits have been saying for years, tape is not dead, so deal with it.
So what are some of the options for data storage, and how do you decide where to store it?
I think that the two primary points for data storage are data volume and the needed speed for data access. They have a real bearing on the storage protocols. For most people, however, their desktop or laptop is their storage device. And unless there is some form of centralized backup or they make their own backups, content that's created on these devices tends to stay there unless it's emailed or sent some other way. So if the system's configured not to reach out, if the backup system's configured not to reach out to individual workstations, then if you're going to try and keep this, there needs to be some form of central repository where key documents are stored. And these days, that increasingly becomes, ironically, the email system. Most documents are sent through the email system, and so this ends up becoming the central repository, whether this is planned or otherwise. For those working in offices as opposed to remotely, from a desktop attached to a network, there are a variety of types of backup that can occur, and they really depend on the type of data and also the type of protocol involved. The sorts of backup protocols you hear about are full, daily, incremental, upon change, block level, and so on. Basically, they represent whether you're backing up everything or just the file that's changed since the last backup that would be an incremental, or just the parts of the file that changed themselves, and that would be a block level. All these approaches are valid, and they all have their uses. And if you think about it, if you've got a disaster, the last thing you want to do is do a file-by-file restore. You want everything back as rapidly as possible. So full backups are very potent. Data can obviously be stored in a variety of locations, from locally on a thumb drive, which is a really bad idea, to, again, local storage on the disk. Again, what happens if your computer dies or is lost? To centrally, where the data may be backed up on the tape or another disk, or even another disk somewhere in the cloud. Where it is stored should be dependent upon how quickly it is needed. This is not always the case, and many companies don't bother to think about this aspect, but it's crucial, as we'll discuss later. However, much more importantly, the type of information that has been created needs to be the dictating factor as to where it's stored. There have been a number of cases recently where the IT department have claimed great cost savings by allowing users to archive their data locally on the PC. However, as soon as the first litigation has appeared that requires this data, then these cost savings are lost, in fact, they're decimated, as each individual workstation now has to be visited and this information located and copied off. Along similar lines have been companies who have stored large amounts of information in the cloud using vendors without adequate, who literally don't provide adequate mass backup capabilities. And so if the information's been needed quickly, they can't provide it. So the information, while stored, has effectively been trapped.
Well, it'd be fun to do a podcast just on that one topic,
yeah.
Where that's going, where how to manage those forms of data. But charging in along in the sort of overview program, you got to tackle it somehow. So who's involved in a best case scenario for deciding data storage rules?
Good question. I like this one. This really depends on the size and type of the company. At a minimum, it should be a combination of both the IT team and the end user, not just IT. The goals here are to educate the IT department of the types of data or information the end user creates and needs to perform their job. In the event of a business interruption or disaster, there needs to be a coordinated effort and a pre-established plan and protocol that says what applications and what data will be restored first and in what order and why. This is commonly known as a disaster recovery or business continuity plan. However, having a plan is not enough. It needs to be tested with dry run-throughs and even literally wet run-throughs several times a year. Beyond the IT and the users, there are two other important groups who must have a say as to what it's stored. And if you are in a company that has compliance and regulatory teams who, by law, under penalty of fines and sanctions, they're required to ensure that certain classes of information are first backed up and, secondly, are preserved for certain time periods. So these people have to have a say. The rules and regulations here are stringent and complex, and they vary from industry to industry and even state to state. So it is, not involving them is a big mistake. And the final player, again, most people overlook this, the final player is the legal department. There's normally a gulf in understanding between these two departments. As we know, they speak totally different languages and barely understand one another. What is crucial for every organization is to appoint a trusted and respected liaison between these two groups. I can't overemphasize this enough. You've got to have somebody who speaks both languages, one individual. A reasonable-sized litigation with far-reaching data discovery requests will cripple most companies' IT budgets. So it's vital that companies ensure that data typically needed for litigation purposes is stored in a manner which is both readily accessible and viable over a long term. This is obviously a complex subject, and time doesn't permit us to delve into this more deeply. However, there are a number of strategies that can be imposed here that provide very significant savings for any company who is sensible enough to adopt them.
When should you re-review your data storage process that maybe you've put in place early, in that last question? And let's also talk about the data storage method. Walk me through some of the considerations on how to choose the best methods for storing data.
Okay. At the high level, storage decisions and protocols should be revised on an event or budget or periodic basis. Let's look at a few scenarios. If you've ever been involved in an IT budget, small decisions can be made quickly or slowly or very slowly. One company I worked with, they took 18 months to decide what they were going to buy. That's a long time. If you consider storage over the last...
Must have been a big company.
It was a very big company. By the time I received a new Sun workstation, it was already obsolete. I love that. Over the last 18 to 24 months, if you consider what hard drive capacities have done. They've gone from 500 gigabytes up to 2 terabytes. So they've almost tripled. By 2013, some pundits say we'll have 10 terabyte hard drives. So this is a result of areal densities continuing to increase. And eventually one day, just as we've stopped using floppy disks, we'll stop using spinning disk altogether. So solid state is coming, and it's coming pretty quickly. When you're creating a budget, storage and compute capacity are usually the two biggest line items. Increasingly, some of these decisions involve moving these requirements to the cloud. However, this is not really practical. The cloud's not yet ready for high data volume. You know, there are real constraints with data transfer. So while the situation's improving, the reality is that the existing internet infrastructure has been really stretched, and you can read about that on a fairly regular basis. So going back to how often we should look at this, whenever a new mission-critical application is installed, there needs to be discussion about whether this application, you know, where the application data actually resides in the data hierarchy within the business continuity plan. If you review this hierarchy on a continual basis, and if the IT departments and legal departments, through their IT liaison, are part of this process, then the key stakeholders will have a say in what is and is not critical and how the data should be managed. The sorts of decisions that are needed here is how much is stored and how often does it need to be stored, hourly, weekly, what have you, which elements do not need to be backed up at all and can be ignored, and where should it be stored to for ease of future use or also cleanup. However, things are typically not this well planned, and if you're a company that's facing litigation for the first time, then it's time for you to review the speed of recovery of potentially relevant information before you have to do it. In other words, if you've got the notice in your hands, then you need to start discussing this with your IT folks. You may find, as many organizations do, that you don't know where your data is or what you actually have stored. This is especially true when there's been changeover of key IT staff. If you've lost key IT staff, one approach here is to call up these staff at their new companies and simply ask them what they did, how they did it, where the data might be. This is a great first step and will save you lots of wasted time trying to guess what they did. But to round this all up, as much as possible, key storage decisions should be centrally documented, ideally published with and maintained within the business continuity plan.
And it doesn't sound like you ever get the end of job on this one. It's constantly changing.
Absolutely right.
Okay. Absolutely right. Well, you know, in that process, how would you say record retention and legal holds play into the data management issue? And I should mention, first week of December, I'm doing a podcast with a record manager and a partner in a litigation group to sort of talk about that interplay. So I find it an interesting area. So why don't you give us the technology side of it?
Okay. Well, the biggest complaint I've heard is from the IT departments who get told, hold this, hold this, hold this, and they don't get told when the legal hold is finished. And after they've had 3, 4, 5 of those and all their storage pools are full, they simply ignore the legal department. This is obviously far from ideal. And again, it points to the need for a trusted advisor who acts as an intermediary between the two departments. So back to the question. Records retention is always a challenge. However, it's a lot easier these days as systems now understand the needs for holds across multiple time periods. So the technology has changed, and it continues to change. So this feature set is increasingly becoming a standard in many of the backup and archiving tools. If you're using an older version of some software and it doesn't have this feature, check for an update or contact your vendor and ask for their plans for this, because it should be in place by now. I mean, all the big systems have this. If your system doesn't have these capabilities and you can't create, you can't basically say, I want to isolate this one pool, then you may have to think slightly outside the box and create a special backup that takes the affected records and copies them to a standalone device, whether it be a DVD or disk or tape. The rules here are pretty simple. The record has to be preserved for the longer time period of either the legal holds or the retention period. Obviously, there are some caveats here. If you do create these special backups, then these need to be clearly documented and really rigorously tracked so that when the hold expires, these backups can be purged. It's a good idea in this instance to attach the location of these backups to the legal hold notice so that when the hold is terminated, everyone knows where this data is saved to. I've used this company's lack of cleanup. It's a great source of information for new investigations. Failure to manage these pockets of information can be a great news for opposing counsel, especially if they think to ask about such treasure troves.
Yeah, I did a really neat podcast with Jim Michaelowitz talking about the last step of the EDRM model, which was basically purging, you know?
Yep.
And anyway.
Bingo.
Well, let's talk about some specific data mismanagement issues. We talk a lot about where we're going. Let's talk about where we've gone. The old stuff we created, which we've stored, can create data storage issues in the form of legacy issues. First of all, what do we do about some of the paper? You know, some might argue, or what do we do about paper in general? Some might argue it's the safest medium for storing data long term, but what about the cost of tracking and recall?
Paper is a great storage medium. It's the safest medium as long as it's stored properly. We know it tends to have a problem with water and obviously heat. However, as long as it's stored properly, then it should last for a long time. It's also one of the most impractical storage methods, too. Paper is hard to track, and it's even harder to search. So unless you're rigorous about listing what each document is and keeping this in a centrally searchable archive, then what do you have? Lots and lots of boxes of paper. If you think about it from a volume point of view, then paper's not so bad. It's just a hassle. Depending on who you speak to, and the type of data represented, a gigabyte represents between 30 and 70,000 pages. So if we take the midpoint and multiply things out, the average laptop contains business information that, if it were printed, would be the height of the Sears Tower. That's a lot of paper. So if documents do need to be kept, then I would say, if you've got the budget for it, that scanning them with optical character recognition, or OCR, it's a good idea. OCR is not perfect, so I wouldn't OCR and throw the paper away, because OCR, even on its best day, is only 99% accurate. So 99% means one mistake in 100 characters, or almost one mistake every other line. And if you think, if you get your OCR and you have your text, you can now link that, in theory, to a conceptual search program, so at least you have an idea of the topics or concepts discussed in the document. There's obviously a great deal of cost to this, but unfortunately, most people adopt the approach of file and forget. And the problem only grows. For most companies, it's too big a problem to deal with. If you consider storage vendors like Iron Mountain, they make a fortune from this. A few years ago, someone told me they were storing over 4 billion boxes of paper. I mean, who knows what the number is today?
And they don't even have to deal with new technology.
Nope.
So do we have similar potential for mismanagement of data with older technologies such as hardware, data, electronic storage media, and data centers too?
Oh, absolutely. This is just as bad and more expensive. I just finished working on a case where we were recalling data from the mid-1990s on an old VAX system. For my client, it was a good thing this data was not purged, as it's going to represent the basis for a very large lawsuit. However, the cost and time and effort to get this data is not inconsiderable. And had the company I've been visiting put in place a proper records retention policy and followed it, I'd have not been able to get access to this information. As it was, I found these tapes lying around in the dark corner of the data center. And unfortunately, this is not so unusual. I've been asked to recall data 30 and 40 years old. I've had to get data back to 1968. And I've been able to do so. The older style backup tapes, they work surprisingly well and can store data for many, many years if the tapes are properly managed. And also if there's proper documentation saying what they are and contain. However, as we know, this is usually not the case. We've all heard about the Morgan Stanley fiasco. I was the expert on this case and firsthand heard the explanations of the director of IT about his looking for data in locations that other staff would not have even known about, and finding all these tapes and his realization that these tapes had not been produced for many of the earlier matters. When he said this, it was like a bombshell moment in the hearings, and the court was silent for almost a minute. You could see all the lawyers looking at each other.
I'm sure.
Everyone was thinking about the consequences, and it was like, okay.
The plaintiff counsel was probably smiling, though, right?
Oh, you better believe it.
Okay.
Anyway, since then I've literally been witness to many such discoveries. For one Fortune 25 client, we uncovered 33,000 items scattered across 34 different offices, all undocumented, all unmanaged. For another, this was fun. I found their exchange backup tapes under a pile of boxes and old computer equipment that was destined for recycle. You can imagine the looks on their faces. Anyway, companies really do need to clean up. Just as you do spring cleaning, they need to have a mechanism for allowing staff to turn in all their older storage technology. And it needs to be performed rigorously, one room at a time, drawer by drawer, literally desk by desk, behind the cubicle walls, under the desks, looking in all storage closets. You'd be absolutely amazed at what's turned up. The other side of it basically is people get blind to looking at stuff. I've been in data centers, especially older, less used ones, or ones that were shut down or shut in, and found just boxes and boxes of stuff lying on the ground. I mean, the IT staff are so used to seeing a certain box in a certain location, they ignore it. So when somebody else walks in and says, "Hey, what's in there?" "I don't know, it's always been there." So let's say this can be a one-time event. It's usually pretty revealing, but once you've done it, you really have broken the back of the issue, typically.
Well, how about the commingling of data, which happens all the time? I think of documents like board minutes, which have multiple issues in them. How do we deal with that and the complexity it creates for data management? And can concept searching assist in this area?
Yeah, let's explain what commingling is for those who are not familiar with it. Commingling is when data from two or more separate clients is stored on the same physical device, whether it be tape or disk. Now, normally this is not an issue if it's done properly, where the blobs of data can be logically separated so that the operating system knows which items belong to whom. However, I've seen this a number of times. This process can fail, or the service provider makes a mistake. Or sometimes the two companies part ways and the data truly needs to be separated out, and yet the storage vendor has lost the records of whose data is stored on what device. I was involved in one of these types of cases, and well over 100 terabytes of data needed to be culled. Initially, it was a disaster, a lot of shouting and a lot of arm waving, but eventually cooler heads prevailed, and legal counsel for both sides got together and developed protocols that led to a mass purging of the older data that was obviously beyond its retention period. They determined the best thing to do in terms of remaining neutral was to say, we'll use a trusted third party to perform the restoration. So in this case, they achieved separation by looking at the various file paths for each file and putting it in one bucket or another. It wasn't pretty. It was very expensive. And this data management commingling cost-saving approach ending up costing both organizations an absolute fortune. So if your organization is commingling, this needs to be performed very carefully with solid performance guarantees and obviously penalties for non-conformance. And it needs to be made painfully clear to the operations staff that they check and recheck any and all data production requests to ensure that one party does not receive the other party's data, because that's a big no-no. So what do you do if the data is commingled and you need to separate it quickly? One approach, it's again a newer approach, is to try and use an advanced conceptual search tool. This is not 100% foolproof, especially if the two or three companies have worked together, but it's certainly a good start. Yeah, you can key on metadata and you can drill down, but obviously if you now bin the documents based on what they're talking about, it allows the companies to filter their data up front and decide what needs to really be kept and what can be defensively disposed of. So if you have this task, do consider conceptual search, because it will do things that regular search can't. But as with all technologies, you know, your mileage may vary, and choose your tool set wisely. Some of the implementations of this technology are not as good as others.
Well, let's talk about inaccessible data forms. You know, and we talked about backup tapes earlier not being dead, and that jumps out as an example that everyone knows about. What are your thoughts about inaccessible ESI and when it's truly inaccessible, or is this really just a proportionality issue?
So let's take a step back. Until recently, data accessibility really depended on having access to the right combination of hardware and storage medium, and most importantly, people. People who knew how to use these tools. So if you had this magic combination, which is often hard to do, and assuming everything worked, then you could gain access to the data. However, the challenge was then what you did with it, as you might have been able to restore it into its, you know, native environment and its, or the precise environment it was created in. However, it's now trapped inside its own little world. And if there are no export capabilities within the software or from the hardware, then things get bogged down very quickly. Obviously, you can examine the data in situ, but this is hardly convenient and doesn't allow for redaction and so on. So obviously, another approach was needed. One method that's been developed has been the one of non-native restoration tools. Non-native software does not need access to catalogs or original operating systems. However, it does depend on the hardware and the storage medium working together. You have to have the right tape drive or disk drive. You can't get around this aspect. However, even if you do, if you have a bad tape, it doesn't matter what software you have, bad is bad. If the drive says, hey, I can't read this, maybe you can try the tape on another drive. But again, if that drive gives up, then you have a bad tape and you simply can't get there. And it's the same thing's true with magneto-optical disks or MO disks. Magneto-optical refers to the old fixed format disks and also CDs and DVDs. Again, if these are reported bad, then the data will be inaccessible. There are a few companies like EMAG, Renew, NDCI, and Index Engines. They all offer approaches to deal with these problems, and they're usually pretty effective. So restoration techniques have improved tremendously over the last 5 years, and costs are now very reasonable for the restoration. Most people in ignorance moan about the high cost of reading tapes. This is not the high cost. The real cost comes afterwards, trying to sort through the terabytes and terabytes of loose data, trying to figure out what you have and what you need. Tapes and such like really are a black art. They take specialist knowledge, and they have their own special language and approaches. There are very few people who truly understand them and how to restore them properly. So this really is a part of the myth of their inaccessibility. They are largely accessible. However, you have to find someone on either side of the matter who can talk tape or disk or data. And once the conversion conversation's going, then the tapes themselves are often very recoverable. So the more your tape expert is able to find out about the tapes, often the fewer tapes need to be restored. I worked on a case a few years ago where we spent a while figuring out what these 6,000 tapes were, and we managed to eliminate all but 10% of these. We then sent these out to be scanned, where we literally looked at the servers that were on the tapes, and established that literally less than 30 of the original 6,000 were even restoration candidates. And they were bad restoration candidates, at which point both sides agreed that the tapes were out of scope. So we saved the client an absolute fortune. But it did take someone to drill down and figure out just what this data actually represented.
It is interesting. I'm thinking of the old shoe cobbler that still exists, and you love finding people that can work on your old shoes. But anyway, and the other thing that jumped out of that was sort of, I did a podcast on a database reviewing hard to access information out of databases, and it seems sometimes it's not so hard to know the data is there, but actually getting it out to review it requires some collaborating with the other side and trying to think these things through creatively. But anyway, let's talk about how ESI data is really everywhere. How do you manage this, especially when it comes in so many forms and has so many different locations?
I was giving a presentation at Georgetown a few months ago, and one of my co-presenters, Marty Jaron, who some of you all know, he'd come up with a list of over 40 different locations where ESI is commonly stored and could be referenced. It was a great list. One of his favorites was for divorce cases, and it was the toll road easy pass transponder that allowed you to see where the car was or was not. So, interesting. While these sorts of technology are fun, but the greatest evolutions in ESI currently are the messaging capabilities within social media sites. If you talked a few years ago, people were worried about what to do with IM, or instant messaging. That's the least of our worries. Social media sites are where companies have very little control over what their employees post or say. Savvy companies are rushing to plug this gap. However, there are real concerns over employee privacy and other issues which the lawmakers are still arguing over. It's very complex, and too often companies only find out about a problematic posting on a social site long after it's become public knowledge. My advice to companies is to ensure they understand what types of technology they have in place within their workspace and develop plans for either tracking or management. With thumb drives being so small and now being able to hold well over 100 gigabytes, trying to keep track of every bit and byte is not realistically possible, unless you're imposing absolute draconian levels of control. A company has to decide what it wants to do. And if this means shutting down the USB ports and the Bluetooth ports on everyone's computers or disabling the use of external portable storage devices, then these policies need to be drawn up, published, put into place, and enforced. Employee education is a big factor here. Guiding the employees about what and what is not acceptable is an important first step. The other side of this is to ensure that current record retention plans also deal with the types of media that are used in-house, and also set up schedules for periodic reviews and audits of what is stored off-site and at other remote locations to ensure that company does not create silos of forgotten or unmanaged data.
Well, we've talked about some of the headaches with where data is stored, how do you manage it, and how do you put these systems together. But you know, it errs to be human, and this is a pretty complicated area. So, you know, I think a practical question is what can happen if you mess up data management?
I agree, it's very complicated, and it is a human problem. So the case we all know about, the poster child, Morgan Stanley. Beyond the fraud, there were several prominent IT issues that, if I was to step back, I would characterize them as essentially revolving around communications. So someone forgot to tell the tape librarian to purge the retired data once these tapes had hit their expiration point. So these old tapes, well past their kill-by date, sat around in an off-site archive only to be discovered and entered into evidence. Someone forgot to tell the operators to clean up the old data centers. So piles of tapes that should have been under some form of record management policy sat there for years, waiting to be rediscovered. Someone did not communicate clearly the priority of the legal discovery request to the individual tasked with information retrieval. Had there been clearer communication lines between those in the trenches doing the work and those asking for the data, who knows what the outcome of this matter might have been? So if I take a step back from this, data management really is about being able to store, track, manage, identify, retrieve, and most importantly, produce all within a timely fashion. Some organizations clean up or delete data too soon. You know, this is known as spoliation and has various other names. There are plenty of cases and case law surrounding this. And you don't really want your organization to be added to this auspicious list. So part of the role of your IT legal liaison staff member has to be to ensure that data that should be preserved is being, and also when the case ends, that data that should be deleted is. It's a very important point. I've seen these sorts of issues in the largest companies in the countries. I sat next to a senior VP of operations who'd been with the company for 27 years. He told me I was wasting his time. And within an hour and a half of searching his palatial headquarters in New York with him by my side, I watched him squirm as he tried to explain why there were about 200 old BlackBerries sitting in front of him in an old forgotten closet we just opened up. These devices were in front of roughly 300 hard drives. Again, sitting there abandoned with a note saying, save for so-and-so. And I asked who so-and-so was. He said, oh, he left 2 years ago. So you can only imagine what he was thinking. His face said it all. We connected that one of the BlackBerries, and it was full of email. So enough said. So communication and record keeping are really crucial here. A company cannot rely on one person's memories or one person's skills. People move on. And when they move on, so does their institutional knowledge. You have to have a plan and live and work the plan, and it needs to be audited on a regular basis, at least once or twice a year, the same as your disaster recovery or business continuity plan.
Well, let's look a little bit to the future now. You know, where is data management taking us? And I jokingly said, you know, will we ever get there? Are we anywhere near getting there?
I'd say we're getting there, yeah. I think the demands of litigation have literally caused or forced there to be improvements in the ability to perform more granular data management from both a storage, identification, and recall standpoint. It used to be that you could control your actions, or you could basically see things at the server or directory level. Now you have implicit control at the file level. My favorite backup software is IBM's TSM, or Tivoli Storage Manager, that used to be called ADSM. This is true enterprise-class software. It's been in consistent development for over 20 years, and is very sophisticated. They, with a number of other companies, have recently rolled out the ability to perform block-level backups. So in English, this means that just the part of the file that has changed is saved. So if I change a contract and I say, you know, payment terms will be 45 days and I change this to 60 days, just the text for the 60 is backed up. A and not the whole document. This results obviously in a very fast backup, and it's saved to all, you know, along with all the other changed blocks that occurred in that document. However, this means the file itself is now fragmented across many different storage areas, and if it needs to be reconstituted, then the recipe for how to put Humpty Dumpty back together again needs to be followed in the correct sequence. And if one of those pieces is missing or damaged, file construction or file reconstruction may not be possible. Fortunately, this is very rare. It's, you know, it's the exception rather than the rule, but it does point to the tremendous behind-the-scenes complexity of these tools that we now rely on to make our lives a lot easier. When you combine this with improved retention scheduling, such as the legal hold technologies, data management technologies really are improving. The challenge, though, is knowing what to store and what to throw away. Not everything needs to be kept. Jokes, messages about the ball game or the party and what have you, have no business value, and yet people cannot be bothered to clean this up, so it remains stored. One software I like for small businesses is GoodSync. That's GoodSync. I like what they're doing. It's an impressive solution. It's great for small businesses who can't afford or don't want to get into the whole data management process, but it does allow them to keep it and be safe. So, as we all know, we're in a challenging time financially. Many companies know they need to do a better job, and unless they have been a party to a legal discovery, they're reluctant to spend any more than they absolutely have to. Many have trimmed their IT budgets and staffing to a bone, and so while there's a desire to implement newer technologies, people are understandably dragging their feet. And they're looking, you know, outside of the traditional in-house solutions and, where possible, outsourcing. So the term you hear again and again, we hear the term SaaS or software as a service. You know, backup on a SaaS basis has been with us for a number of years. The term SaaS is often used interchangeably with the cloud. So people are now talking about backing up to the cloud as though it was something new and wonderful. Basically, what people are saying, we're backing up to somewhere outside of my data center. It's not new, and if people choose to go this route, there are many logistical and security considerations that need to be put into place first.
Okay, and I might as well ask the self-serving question. Will data storage tools eliminate the need for litigation support technology, or do we still have a long way to go before we hit that nirvana, if we ever do?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure that conventional storage tools will help directly, of course, unless the data is indexed as it is stored. So some companies are doing this, but they're still indexing in a Boolean sense, you know, as per DT search and what have you, and not a conceptual one. A few companies, ourselves included, are developing archiving technology that performs conceptual search capabilities upon data ingestion. The difference here is that when a case is initiated, the concept clusters will have already been formed, making early case assessment straightforward. So nirvana is in sight, but we ain't there yet. If you consider this with the Boolean results, then the difference is night and day. As with Boolean search, you're getting keywords and phrases without the ability to filter the words on how they're used or their meanings. Either way, whether it's Boolean or concept, both approaches are a great improvement on standard storage technology, which just passes the data through with no thought as to interrogating it for content. So storage technologies are going to eliminate the need for some litigation support technology. However, only if companies are forward-thinking enough to employ such technologies within their data centers. And this really is the challenge. IT managers need to have experienced the pain of e-discovery to realize the benefits of being prepared. Most companies only implement a proactive e-discovery stance once they have first experienced the cost and pain of a reactive approach. And while this is backwards, it's akin to retrofitting a sprinkler system to the building after you've had to call in the fire department once or twice.
Well, if you look at e-discovery as partially a technology problem and partially, and I think it should be emphasized, and you have already, a communication problem, between professionals trying to get their arms around ESI and evaluate it in a litigation context. It would seem to me there's a lot of data involved in that process which needs to be communicated. And we talked about the cloud. It looks like an obvious solution to having scarce resources communicate with each other. Do you think lawyers will ever embrace the cloud as a way to project manage electronic discovery? Can the rewards of the efficiency offered by the cloud sway some despite the risk of data being breached?
This is another great question. I go back to saying that the cloud is somewhat synonymous with the terms SaaS, or software as a service. So for our purposes, this means that the data is not stored on site, but it's stored somewhere else. For the end user, as long as data access is quick, they don't care where it is. However, if you're a review attorney and you have to examine 500 to 1,000 documents a day, network speed and data location transparencies are big issues. If you have to wait 30 to 60 seconds or longer for each file to appear, then there's going to be complaints. Many companies now offer cloud-based discovery. You know, we've been doing it since 2004, for example. It's nothing new. The issue is the quality of the software and the types of processing and project flow management contained within these various offerings. Discovery can be very rigorous with impossibly tight deadlines, as we all know. And as the speed of the internet improves, I do see more and more of this activities moving off-site. These sorts of technologies are especially useful for smaller law firms who do not have the budgets or the in-house staff expertise to set up and manage such systems. However, the big issue is, I believe, project management. And it's an issue regardless of where the data is housed. Obviously, you need feedback from the application to show what files have and have not been reviewed, but data location and reviewer performance or reviewer accuracy, they're not necessarily dependent. Ultimately, you need a solid project management process and reliable and fast data access. So to answer the last part of your question about data security, if you're going to store data outside of your data center, you have to take basic responsibility for that data. If you're hosting it somewhere else, you need to verify the security of your vendor, and you can't assume that once it's in the cloud, you're no longer responsible for data security. So you need to ensure your applications are secure and the data is properly protected.
Okay.
Say, you have a question?
No, go ahead.
Okay, so as long as you're using a reputable vendor, data breaches are rare and usually are caused by people being careless with their passwords or access codes. Access to the physical locations where the data is stored is usually via a secure link, and it's usually not the link which is the problem, but the operator or the user and their carelessness. Most companies store the data in an encrypted fashion, so really the only practical way to get to the data is via a front-on approach or via the application itself. So if the passwords are changed on a regular or automated fashion, as long as people can remember them and don't write them down, then security for data in the cloud should not be a concern.
And actually, the thing that I've sort of been noodling in this area is not as much the review component, and which you know, lots of people are very, very comfortable using outsourced review tools as opposed to desktop, just because they're more scalable, and this is usually a very big job. I'm thinking about the disparate vendors who are involved that each have silos of expertise. And if you don't communicate between those silos effectively, just on how the project's going, it's a lot harder to manage these things.
Very true.
That can be sensitive dialogue, sensitive information. But the challenge is people, they're not enough good people. Everyone says that. We all like saying that because we're part of a small club. And how do you maximize good people across geographical locations? I think the cloud has so many possible answers if we can figure out how to package that, what needs to be communicated. make it secure. But that's not my bailiwick. That's just something I think about.
Great.
So anyway, Quinn, thanks again for joining our show. This has been very interesting stuff. I always like a guest that says good questions, since I come up with those oftentimes, and I'll go right back at you. Good answers. I've enjoyed having
you. Appreciate it.
And to our listeners, thank you for listening to our show. And for a complete list of ESI Bytes shows, you can visit www.esibytes.com. And remember what we always say here, you should always visit ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. Again, this is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov. Have a nice day.